confronting authors with real questions about the writing process, the difficult and disheartening publishing industry, and why anyone would choose to torture themselves in the world of writing, this is the Literally Podcast with your host, writer, runner, and the literary voice of Ogden, Utah, Case Johnston. Exposing literature, the authors, the business, the process. The Literally Podcast. All right, thank you for listening to this podcast. This episode of Literally is sponsored by Lexicon and Line. Case, tell us a little something about Lexicon and Line.
Lexicon and Line, it does three things. They are communications consultants, they teach professional business writing and speaking courses, and they are research and data evaluation experts.
And you can find everything about Lexicon Online at lexicononline.com. Please give them a visit, and thank you so much for sponsoring this podcast, Lexicon and Line.
It had begun the night before, just after supper, as the young couple was getting ready to turn in for the night. There were knocks at the door of their small flat. At first, the woman thought it might have been the old lady next door looking to borrow something again. Some flour or a cup of sugar was the usual request, and she could never say no, even though money was scarce and they could barely make do with what they had themselves. It was late, and she figured if she did not answer, the old lady would eventually give up and go back to her apartment. But the knocks grew more insistent until they could no longer be ignored. When at last she wrenched open the door, she was surprised to see not the woman next door, but a police officer in a dark trench coat and a cap pulled low over his brow. "Good evening, ma'am," he said with a polite smile, removing his hat promptly. "Is your husband at home? If it's not too much trouble, I would like to speak with him for a few moments." The woman regarded him cautiously through the cracked door, but his tone was courteous, almost apologetic, and so she stepped aside and let him in. "Yes," she said hesitantly. "May I let him know your name, sir?" "Good evening," the officer offered once more in place of his name, and it took her a moment to realize that her husband had appeared behind her. He had taken off his tie, and his hands were still wet from washing up after supper. Ambling towards them, he unrolled his shirt with sleeves. "Your wife was kind enough to invite me in. I hope it's all right, given the hour." At the table, they settled like old friends, sharing a glass of brandy after a hard day's work. The clock ticked behind them in tune with the sound of their voices, even uneventful. An hour had passed, maybe two, and neither had shifted an inch. Yet there was a fatigue that had overtaken her husband. He kept rubbing his eyes, and beads of perspiration had appeared on his forehead, on his upper lip. As they talked, she had finished cleaning the kitchen and had put their young daughter to bed. Now in the other room, she was pacing the floor as quietly as she could, pretending that she too was asleep. There had been questions, endless questions, about her father-in-law, his former post in the royal parliament, how much her husband knew about the king's presence arrangements, and that, she realized, could mean only one thing for them. Mere months earlier, King Carol II's abdication from the throne astonished all of Europe. He had run in a hail of bullets, chased out of the country like a hunted animal. Not that he had ever been popular with his people. But in the short time before his abdication, the people's distaste for Carol had intensified, fueled by his handing over of Romanian territories to Hungary and Russia without contest, without a single gun being fired. The whole thing that made the pot boil, however, causing riots to erupt on the streets, was his unwillingness to give up Magda Lupescu, his mistress of 20 years, for whom he would forego his country, an honor and rightful queen, the mother of his only child. People hurled obscenities and insulted them, and children threw stones at the royal convoy as their cars sped hastily through the streets of Bucharest. Magda and Carol hidden from view in the rear seat of their Rolls Royce. "Death to the Jewish whore," they shouted angrily as the two ran up the steps of the palace where Magda had been living for years, a reigning queen in all but name. When shots were fired at the palace windows, it had all become too much. Packing just bare necessities, Carol and Magda flew in the night on a train to Spain with just a few trunks and a handful of the loyal friends. Romania was then ran by Hitler's right-hand man, General Antonescu, with young Prince Michael, a mere puppet king, and Antonescu's legionaries in their mad quest for blood, murdering 60 of Carol's former aides and turning the city into a battleground. "I've already answered all of your questions, officer," she heard her husband say. "My father has never discussed professional matters with anyone, especially not with me." "What about the excursions you took to the country when you were a boy? It is a known fact, sir, that your father was a childhood friend of Magda Lupescu. Was she there on those long vacations?" "Who are you speaking of?" "The king's mistress, sir. The woman who helped your father obtain a position in the cabinet, who brought other Jews like herself under his wing, who cost him the throne. Do you mean to tell me you do not know who she is?" The officer's voice was no longer restrained. It was just short of a yell. Even so, the young man regarded him quietly. "I do not remember any such excursions," he said. "I am sorry." Leaning back in his chair, the officer loosened the top button of his collar and took a gulp of his tea. In the downturned corners of his forced smile, the young man saw it all: the disdain for his family, the hatred, the frustration with his interrogation that was going nowhere. "You will need to come with me to the precinct. Just protocol, you understand. But we have a few more questions. Should take no more than an hour." Nodding faintly, the young man looked down at his hands. There was no point in arguing. It would only make matters worse. So he stood without any resistance and began making his way to the door. But then, the words he prayed would not be uttered were there, out in the open, hitting him squarely in the back. "Your wife and daughter, they need to come too." "Why?" he asked, not turning, not daring to. "They've done nothing. Our daughter is only 3. They were beyond conversation now. It was done with, and he heard it in the silence that followed, in the sharpness of the officer's steps as he approached the window and motioned to the patrol car below. "By all means, we will come with you," he said now. His head was spinning, and the panic that had risen inside him caused him to speak too fast. It took an effort to slow down, breathe normally. "If I could just have a few minutes to explain the situation to my wife. She gets extremely agitated, you see. I think my talking to her first might make our visit to the precinct a little easier." He clasped his hands in a pleading gesture that implied, "We are both men. We understand how delicate women can be." The officer retreated from the window, looked at his watch. He did not like being in the situations. He much preferred marching ordinary Jews out of their homes. But this particular family had to be handled with care. These were his orders. Besides, the last thing he wanted to witness was the hysterics of this man's wife. Nothing displaced him more than a scene. "You have 10 minutes, starting now," he spat, calculating that an hour from now, if she agreed to come along peacefully, he would be sipping his drink in the corner bar. "I'll be outside." Then placing his hat on his head, he marched out of the flat, slamming the door behind him. There was disarray in the desk drawer, too many things, envelopes and bills that were still to be paid, a letter opener that sliced along his finger, making him wince. Lay. He felt them, a large stack of them, right where he'd placed them, in a hidden compartment, there for an emergency or a last-minute trip. Never something like this. He shoved them hastily into his shirt's pockets, his pant pockets, too, inside his socks. There was a look when he burst through the bedroom door. A brief, knowing look, no words, as he lifted the girl out of her bed. From the corner of his eye, he saw his wife grab a shawl, a bonnet for the girl, her blanket. He saw her look around the room for her shoes, settling on the slippers. And then they were running, with his daughter in his arms. They were running towards the kitchen and out the back door leading to the service stairs. And his heart was pounding, pounding, like it never had in all of his 27 years. It was warm in the boiler room, warm and damp, and the water heater was churning along, which was a good thing, for it offered some insulation, cocooned them in a strange way. They had been lucky, given the circumstances, downright blessed, that the guards at the front gate had their backs turned and were laughing, smoking a cigarette, as the three of them slithered right past them and into the bowels of the building. But now that they were here, the momentary feeling of safety was quickly dissipating. They were not safe, not by a long shot, with the guards back on the lookout and the little girl whimpering in her mother's arms. "It's all right," she crooned, rocking her, smoothing her face. "It's all right." And the way she smiled seemed to indicate this was only a game, a make-believe game they would laugh about later by the fireplace. But when her fingers touched her lips and went flat, there was something that appeared in the tiny, wise eyes, and the girl knew she had to keep quiet. From a dusty corner, he dragged a few wooden crates and stacked them high against the wall. It seemed desperate, unlikely to work, yet there seemed to be no other choice, no other way out. Thus, he was almost surprised when he climbed on the very last one, stretching his arms as if he meant to reach for the sky, that he could touch the edge of the basement window. Wiping away dusty cobwebs, he cranked it open, careful not to make any noise. The opening was barely wide enough for a child to slip through, yet he tried not to linger on this fact as he wedged his way out 1 centimeter at a time, grabbing the iron bars on the other side of the window. As he collapsed on the sidewalk above, he had to remind himself that this was no great victory. He had to act quickly. "Give her to me," he whispered down to his wife. "Give her to me now." Through the cavity, he groped for his daughter, the tiny arms, the soft little body, the hair so long and lush for her young age. When he pulled at her a little too roughly, he heard her cry out, and his heart nearly shattered, but he did not relent. The blood was pounding in his temples, and he thought, "We will be caught now. We will be shot. She will not see her fourth year." He feared this with every fiber in his body as he yanked her through with one final tug. Then his wife was out too, and they were together again, huddled against one another, breaths and arms intertwined, trembling in the darkness.
This is Case Johnston. This is the Literally Podcast. Today we're talking with Roxanne Valetsos about her book, The Girl They Left Behind. Roxanne Valetsos was born in Bucharest, Romania, and moved to California with her family as a young teen. Already fluent in English and French, she began writing short stories about growing up in her native Eastern Europe. Building on her love of the written language, she obtained a bachelor's degree in journalism and has worked as an editor, content writer, and marketing manager for several Fortune 500 companies. To learn more, visit roxanne-valetsos.com. Valetsos, sorry. Roxanne just read from chapter 6 of The Girl They Left Behind, a book that it only took me 2 days to read, which, as Brandon knows and those who have listened to the podcast before, this is a feat for me, which means that I was in it, and for me to read quickly says a lot about a book. And I was hooked immediately. Like I said, Roxanne read from chapter 6, but this was really... Though there are other chapters that begin the book, this is the beginning of Natalia's journey, where her parents make the decision to leave her on a doorstep so that she will have a chance to live during the Nazi occupation in 1941. As quick summary for those who have not read the book, and I suggest that you do, this book gives us a really nice glimpse into what it was like during the early 1940s in occupied Romania, first by the Nazi regime and then a movement into the Soviet regime, and where how families were affected by those two regimes, first by the Nazi regime and then by the Soviet regime when they took over after the war, or during and after the war. And it's a telling book historically. I mean, there's a lot of research that's been placed into this book, and it's also a telling story because it has true deep roots within Roxanne's own family history. I read the book in 2 days for those two reasons. There was heart in it, as well as this, and as a researcher for most of my stuff is creative nonfiction, as you know. As a researcher, I loved all of these details that came in fluidly within the prose, within dialogue about what was happening in Romania in the 1940s, as well as a story and with a plot. So thank you, Roxanne, for joining us today. I mean, we're really, really lucky to have you. Thanks for joining us on such short notice. So tell us about that chapter that you read, why you chose to read it, and for listeners and those who were going to purchase the book, what does this chapter mean to the overall book?
So as you said, Case, I think I chose this chapter because it is truly so pivotal to the story. It is, in fact, chapter 6. But in a very great sense, it truly is where the story of this little girl begins. And also a pivotal point in the lives of the two families, which, you know, have such a huge part of her life, her biological family, as well as her adoptive family, which we have not yet met at this point in the chapter. But this is sort of like where everything sort of... where the entire story stems from.
Yeah, and with this young girl, and she, and as you'll see if you flip to the back of the book, the young girl's is based on your mom's own experience, correct?
Yes.
When you began writing this, what was the impetus for it? I mean, if you read the book, you'll see Roxanne kind of explains it, that she just kind of, that you were just kind of just imagining, and you wanted to go and you wanted to find an answer, even if it was fictionally, to what happened to your biological grandparents.
Exactly. And
went from there.
Yeah. So actually, so twofold. One is that I had grown up with these incredible stories that my mother had shared with me over the years. And she's truly an incredible storyteller. She has such a colorful way of just bringing things to life. And perhaps she's a writer at heart as well.
Mm-hmm.
But I really wanted to sort of capture these incredible stories that she had shared with me over the years about my adoptive grandparents, which are actually in real life the only parents, grandparents that I've ever known. Also wanted to pay tribute to all the sacrifices and everything they had suffered during this terrible time with such dignity, because it had truly had such an impact in my own life. There's so much that I was really able to learn from their courage and, as I said, the dignity with which they, you know, they took on so many adversities. At the same time, I had also grown up with, as you said, this mystery about my biological roots. And that's something that really never leaves you. And even in times when it's not necessarily at the forefront of your consciousness, it's something that is deeply sort of almost embedded in your mind, embedded in your DNA. You really can't escape this question mark, this big question mark of your existence. And although my mother started to really look for them very early in her own life, and all of her efforts were in vain, she was really never able to find anything about them, even in Romania or in the United States, where she went through various organizations. And so at one point in this journey, I felt that perhaps this is where it ends. Perhaps there really isn't, we're never really going to find out anything more about them.
Mm-hmm.
And I think that perhaps that is where the seed for this novel was first planted. This is sort of like where reality ended and my own imagination took over.
Right. And even within chapter 6, it's all imagination, right? I mean, because your mom was so young that she probably wouldn't have remembered a moment like that. And so you had to fill it in.
She was actually younger in real life, although she was obviously found on that exact same night, January 23rd of 1941. She was actually only a year old. And I chose to have Natalia be a little bit older is that I needed her to have an active voice sooner in the novel, while also encompassing the experiences of everyone around her.
Yeah, that makes a lot of sense. And so, I mean, the novel itself, I mean, there's a lot based on your mom's stories. But then there's so much of filling in the blanks to make it a story, to make it one story with one long plot arc. And we're going to talk about the ending a little bit later, where I'm not going to give it away. I want people to buy the book. But it's a heavy novel. I mean, this is, like I said, this is war-torn Romania, and where these two regimes just tore people out of their homes and they murdered people, and the ones that survived got placed in these communist flats where they were next to people they didn't want to live with, who were cruel. And one of the most interesting part about this book, and you please tell me about this when you talk about your research, is how they treated the families that actually had money, how some people treated the families who actually had money before the Soviet Union came in. It was like they'd been waiting their whole lives to spit back or spit on them. And
absolutely.
It's a heavy book. But was within the fiction, within the writing, where did you have fun? Or did you? Maybe I'm making an assumption.
I think I don't want to give too much away, but I think the part that, if you want to call it having fun, but I think the part that I really enjoyed really writing that for me was probably less heavy than anything else in the book was part 3, the romance that emerges, between the two characters, which I'm not sure if I should name or not.
Well, I was going to, well, then if you don't want me to, because I have like 3 questions about that part 3, but Maybe I can do it in a way that doesn't give it away. I can.
The main characters.
Yeah, and so with the love interest at the end, I was wondering during the writing, because you said this is the fun part, so we can explore kind of, you know, where you're really just creating and enjoying it. Did you think that there might be a point where it ended differently between them? Like, was there a point in the writing where you said, this could end differently? Does that make sense?
Yes. And in fact, the ending that is now in the book is not the original ending. Uh-huh. I think that I wanted to leave things between them a little bit more open-ended, but at the same time, and perhaps with a possible sequel in mind.
Mm-hmm.
It was also the editorial input that I had at that time from my editor at Atria, who said, you know, I think perhaps, and again, without giving too much away, you know, she thought that perhaps going in this one direction might make it a little more interesting and a little more, again, open-ended.
Right.
So, yeah.
Good. Well, I'll wait to see. And the readers should wait to see, because we do, and as Roxanne gave away, there is a love story at the end of this book that is a heavy book, and it was nice, I have to say, it was really nicely placed. So the way that you originally wrote it, or the way that you revised it, it gave us at the end of this a really nice breath of fresh air for Natalia, our protagonist. So with all of this, we get three or four different ages for Natalia. When you were writing her, did you know what those ages were going to be, or did that come while seat of your pants, kind of?
I know that it was important for her to, it was important to capture those early years of her life, because truly, that is when so much happened that is actually based in real life. So a lot of the experiences that she goes through from the time that she's three and she's adopted by Anton and Despina and all the way through the end of the war are very much drawn from real life, perhaps more so than any other portion of the book.
Mm-hmm.
So I certainly knew that, you know, we had to go through these formative years in order to capture, you know, all these layers of my grandparents and her story.
Mm-hmm.
Her in her 20s, I think that evolved a little bit more organically. I also felt that in my mind's eye, I needed Natalia to have an identity of her own. So at that point, I was no longer really thinking of my mother, but of one who sort of resembled my mother and was somewhat like her, but not entirely her. And I think I did this for a number of reasons.
Yeah.
One of it, which is that I think it would have been really difficult for me to write that romance with
your mom, with your mom involved. Yeah.
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 But I also wanted, I wanted the story at that point to sort of like take its own course and for her as a character, as I said, to really evolve organically and grow into her adulthood.
Yeah. And you can, that makes a lot of sense. And that a lot of those stories, I mean, you feel your mom was a storyteller, that a lot of those stories come from your grandparents as well, the ones that from the beginning of the book.
Absolutely. So, so many portions in the beginning, especially the first part of the book, are drawn completely from real life. So her adoption and the loss of their summer house, which was bombed actually when Romania switched sides to the Allies and were bombed then by the Germans.
Mm-hmm.
The loss of everything, including the right to work, the sort of reversal of fortune with Victor, all of these factors were in fact drawn almost entirely from real life.
Wow. Wow. I mean, and to be able to jump into that as a writer and to, you know, tell that story had to be a mix of emotion and adrenaline.
Absolutely. And it was incredibly cathartic as well.
Mm-hmm.
I just think that these stories were with me for such a long time. And, you know, of course I have obviously always been drawn to writing. I've been doing it since I was probably 7 or 8 years old, my native Romanian. And then, here in the US, it's also one of the reasons why I majored in journalism. You know, writing has always been this huge part of my life. And I always had this seed, as I said, the seed for the novel that kind of lived within me. Most of my through my teens and early 20s. And it was just sort of waiting for the right time to sort of really, to really grab it and, you know, commit to the idea of delving into it. Didn't happen until about 5 years ago.
Right. Which you can never plan.
You can never plan. That's true. Life has getting in the way.
Yeah. And it came when it should come. Right. And that's the best part. This is Case Johnson. This is the Literally Podcast. Today we're talking with Roxanne Bledsoe about her book, The Girl They Left Behind. I want to talk a bit about research because I love research. Yeah. And the book was, like I said, in the intro, the book weaved research within prose and plot and dialogue and description really, really well. One part of it that really took me was the description of Romania in the 1940s and the homes within the homes. What did you do to provide that to your readers? Because that had to take something that I wouldn't have.
I actually did probably in excess of a year of just straight research, which probably doesn't sound like a lot, but it was a time when I did, again, just immerse myself completely in that specific time period in Romania's history. And I have to say it was not an easy task because Romania's history at the time was not only incredibly turbulent, but very complex. And there were many factions within Romania's own fascist regime that were battling and vying for power. And again, sort of, it was sort of a merry-go-round of people that would rise to power and then murder each other. And it's really rather incredible, the history of this country. But again, things moved really, really quickly through those years. And so I really wanted to obviously not understand very well every subtlety of what happened during that time, but be able to thread it seamlessly through the tales of these two families without taking away from them, if that makes any sense. So I think that was probably my biggest challenge writing this book, was to balance research, really extensive and accurate research, with the tales of the families, which was fictional, and do it in a way where again, they maintain this balance so that the story propels forward in a fluent and natural way.
Right, right. Absolutely. And it's done really well. There's never a point where you feel like that the research is too heavy, but it just, where the research and the history of these, of what's happening, these families feels like it flows in a way that you need it. You absolutely need it. Because you couldn't tell this story without telling that time in Romania, which I learned a lot about. Obviously, I didn't know anything about it. And you felt like you were in the streets of Romania in 1941, which I thought was just extremely, really, really well done. When you, looking at when you left Romania to move to the States compared to what it was like that many years, of course, there was bombings and everything in the early 1940s. What was the difference between the lives of your grandparents after they, you know, which comes up in the book quite a bit, moving to a small flat with shared restrooms and schedules and things that would drive most Americans absolutely crazy, to the Romania that you left?
I actually left that Romania. My family and I moved to the States just before the fall of the wall. Under some unusual circumstances, and actually very incredible circumstances, which perhaps is deserving of a novel in its own. But I actually did get to experience that Romania that is portrayed in my book in the early years of my life. And to be specific, the flat that is described in the novel in which Anton and Despina are moved, in which they're forced to share with three other families, is actually the loft in which I knew them and spent quite a bit of my time as a child. So interesting for me to bring that to life and just kind of to see it through a different lens as I was writing it, sort of like from the outside as opposed to being immersed in it.
Right. And going back now, what's the difference?
Romania is an entirely different country. And, you know, it has not been an easy road for them, actually, sort of clawing through 40 years of the Stalinistic rule and you know, really hardline communism and the Iron Curtain. But it's definitely coming a long way, and I think it's evolving, or rather resuming to a state where it was before the war. So mm-hmm. it's really evolving, and it's moving in the right direction.
Yeah, I mean, I have Scottish friends, and their families they now go to Romania for holiday, you know, and that's the wall came down in what, 89?
92, 91.
And that's not that long ago. I mean, that's recent history. And the book, The Girl I Left Behind, takes you into that Romania. It's a book that everybody should buy. With some of these relationships, even if it was external or maybe internal, did you have any conflict with writing them in the book?
I was probably a bit reticent to write this relationship between Victor and Natalia. Can mm-hmm. we call them? Name them?
Yes, please.
Primarily because the relationship is really fictional. There was no romantic relationship between right. my mother and Victor, even though he very much existed oh. and fulfilled a very similar role in my grandparents' lives and in my mother's life. Mm-hmm. So again, that sort of fact meeting fiction, but the relationship itself, the romance, is fictional. And as I was writing it, I was sort of wondering, you know, what my mother would, you know, right. how this would impact her, or what she would think of it. And again, I ended up actually really enjoying writing this piece of it, because it was one pieces of the novel where I had total creative liberty, and I took it, and I really like writing it.
Mm-hmm. That's yeah. And it's a great part of the last part of the book. I don't want to give too much away. Roxy and I were talking briefly before we began the podcast, that the ending, and this doesn't happen to me that often, but the ending had me choked up and emotional, and I, you know, and so I put it down, and my wife was in the room, and she looked at me, and she was surprised that the ending had me choked up and emotional. And just from a writer's perspective, we know how we do things as other writers, but it did, and it worked.
Thank you.
And Roxanne noted to me as well that it had you choked up as well. Was that part of that catharsis that you just spoke about earlier, or was yeah. it just getting done with the book?
No, it was absolutely cathartic, and in a way, it really came to life for me. And you know, as a writer, you probably know, you know, when we really immerse ourselves in our writing, we're sometimes not just writing but experiencing mm-hmm. everything right along with the characters. And so through her eyes, I sort of had my own chance to see what it might have been. And I'm almost choking up a little bit even saying this, you know, because mm-hmm. there's, with most certitude, I will never meet them or anyone, perhaps no one, anyone in that family ever. And so again, this gave me a chance to sort of envision and live through what it might have been like for if they had actually reunited mm-hmm. and really to kind of give them the ending that they never had in real life.
Right.
For all three of them.
Yeah, it was a beautiful ending, and I urge anybody to pick it up. It'll take you through the history of the war in the early 1940s in a part of the world that we don't hear about that much, at least in the West, in the United States. And it's a journey that Roxanne takes you through this young girl Natalia's life, and the life of her parents, her biological parents as well as her adoptive parents, and what is happening within the world at that time. And so this is a part where either Brandon has a question, or my last question always is there, if there's anything that we haven't discussed here that you would want to share with us about the book, about the writing, about anything that maybe you haven't shared before, I would just want to kind of open it up to you that way.
As I was researching this book, as I mentioned earlier, I came across some incredible facts that even as a native Romanian, I was really unfamiliar with during that time period. And one of the things that I found most fascinating was the story of young King Michael, mm-hmm. who is the son of King Carol, who in the aftermath of Carol's abdication really takes over the throne at a very, very young age. He's actually 18 years old at the time. And because he's so young, he's really more or less just a figure, a puppet figure, because the real power is transitions into the hands of General Antonescu, who is known as being one of Hitler's strongest allies. However, at 2 years later, so to around 1944, Michael actually staged a coup against General Antonescu and had him arrested and shortly executed and resumed power. At this point, Romania switched sides to the Allies, which sort of changed the direction of the whole war. And by some accounts, really shortened the war by quite a few months and saved tens of thousands of people. Mm-hmm. So as I was learning this about young King Michael, I sort of started seeing in my own mind how, you know, this might be a different story that I may want to pursue at some point. And again, not just this period of time during which his presence and intervention is so critical to Romania and Europe's history, but his life after, when he was forced to abdicate by Stalin and ended up in Switzerland with his wife and five daughters and lived a really rather ordinary and quite humble life. Mm-hmm. So King Michael's definitely sort of in the back of my mind for a possible novel that would not have anything to do with this one. It would be its own independent story, but sort of drawing on the research that I came across writing The Girl.
Wow, that's remarkable. Do you think you would, I hope you do it, first off. Secondly, do you think you would take the second part of his life with the normalcy of becoming, you know, going from being so powerful to starting a coup to then moving to Switzerland? Or do you think you would kind of, you know, put it all together in the novel?
I think it would absolutely, and I haven't quite thought it through, but I probably would start with him in Switzerland and do some scenes and flashback mm-hmm. to his. And in order to keep it a novel, I think that I would probably filter the story through a secondary character who is fictional, mm-hmm. Because otherwise, you know, as you know, it becomes really murky. You know, what is nonfiction? What is fiction? And I think that I want to stay in this sort of genre of historical novel or right. historical fiction.
Right.
But again, I this is sort of really rough in my mind. I haven't quite pieced it all together. I'm actually finishing editing a second novel that I'm super excited about. And as soon as I'm done with that one, then I will be ready to sort of really commit fully to this other idea and start exploring all these options.
Wow. All right. What can you give us any clue about that new novel?
The second novel. It has pieces of historical fiction, although it also takes place in modern day New York City, and it spans more than 50 years. So, spanning from pre-war rural Hungary to Budapest of the 1980s. And to the art scene of modern day New York City. Again, 50 years, and it's a story without, again, giving too much away. It's a story of self-discovery and of a lost love that affects the lives of three generations of women. I should probably read through that one. That sounded really choppy.
No, that sounded great. It was fine. No, absolutely. Actually, you know what it is when the worst question anybody could ask is, what's your novel about? And I'm sorry that I...
It's terrifying question.
I know. I'm sorry that I did that, first off. Secondly, you answered it brilliantly. So I think we should, you know what I mean? You really did. People ask me what I'm writing. I'm like, I don't know. I'm writing about dogs.
I think that is the singular question that terrifies most writers.
I know. And I'm so sorry.
That's okay.
I realized after I asked it that what I just did. But you really... You did amazingly with it.
Okay.
Yeah, so we'll keep it. And again, thank you so much for sitting with us. This is Case Johnston. We're talking with Roxanne Valetzos, the author of The Girl They Left Behind. Thanks again so much, Roxanne, for joining us.
Thank you so much. It was wonderful. Oh. Really appreciate the opportunity.
And when the new book comes, we'll talk again for sure.
Absolutely. I would like that. Thank you.
Yeah, absolutely.
All right, thank you for listening to this podcast. This episode of Literally is sponsored by Lexicon and Line. Case? Tell us a little something about Lexicon Online.
Lexicon Online, it does three things. They are communications consultants. They teach professional business writing and speaking courses, and they are research and data evaluation experts.
And you can find everything about Lexicon Online at lexicononline.com. Please give them a visit, and thank you so much for sponsoring this podcast, Lexicon Online.